Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Now that you have a little bit of a sense of how Eastern spiritual practices, in particular the Buddhist schools, which are based on Hindu teaching, orient themselves in terms of looking for satisfaction in this world. Because you notice that's all we're ever doing, looking for satisfaction in this world. And a lot of the time we stumble around a lot. Then we actually get an idea, and then we meet somebody else with an idea, and we sort of go with them for a while, and then our paths split again. And isn't that happening? It's just like weaves. But there is some sense that there's something you're looking for all the time. Maybe you can't say it, maybe you can't name it. Why else would people become drug addicts? You know, those first hits are there. And then there is the memory that for a moment you didn't have any desire. So that's a pretty, and that's what you call in Buddhism garuka karma, a very heavy action which destroys your ability to relate to all other actions. The relative is no longer relative when you have a really heavy action, such as killing, such as an experience of total loving kindness, such as an experience, where there is like just this sudden opening, near-death experiences. You understand what I'm saying, don't you? They're called garuka karma. They're very heavy actions. So sometimes they can cause us just for a moment to look without searching. Can't they? And if they are related to wholesome activity, we tend to be marked by that garuka karma to move in wholesome ways. Does that make sense? If they are related to unwholesome activity, we tend to be marked by that to move in unwholesome ways. Because heavy actions are so powerful. That acting can go over lifetimes. There is also, so not all of us are pushed by what they call in Buddhism garuka karma, but we are all pushed by this sense that there's something missing, a piece left out, something we lost, or something that we're separate from, or something that's out there. And every society has one way or another, when the belly is filled, or not filled, realize that there is also that other hunger for whatever it is we feel separate from. Every society has worked out a teaching or a belief system or a way of ignoring it. Augmenting it or ignoring it or saying it's going to happen this way or going to happen that way. Over the centuries of activity and observation, those belief systems have sort of modified down to a few essential points. The societies who have lived in areas where there hasn't been so much necessity to work so hard to maintain daily existence, live in tropical places, warmer places, places where, fruit grows like which season. Hold my hand out, oh yeah, the mango will fall into that hand. Oh, hold my hand out now, oh yeah. You understand what I'm saying? There is less of a need to focus on the material. Those societies that ripen in areas where there aren't natural barriers like oceans or mountains, and they're adjoining other tribes that might have winter. Would maybe have to get used to the idea of suddenly something appearing called the marauders riding in the middle of autumn or something and grabbing food and riding out and leaving a few dead behind. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So there wouldn't be quite that same ease about material. So there might slowly become more focus on developing a group identity or small group identities, clanning. So it would become maybe societies more involved with creating us and thems. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And there would become like then the sense of me who comes from this family who is related to, and this is how we've passed down. And societies that were like more isolated and subject to a lot of different changes in the material world, like major seasons or, you know, hurricanes quite regularly, would undoubtedly start trying to find some kind of belief system that would explain why no matter what you built was going to get demolished and how to build bigger and better. This is a very sort of crude kind of breakdown. Then these, over time, these different, through trade routes and things, these different kind of credos would meet, and they'd learn from each other or war with each other. And then eventually there would start to become some cultures, like at one time, the sort of the Moors, the Persian, they were the great conquerors, and they also, although they were very much involved with their appreciation of Muhammad and Allah, they also at that time believed in free discussion and listening to, and so they built cities where they had vast numbers of different respected Jews, respected Christians, respected Buddhists, respected Hindus, and had travelers from all over. And you know, the Alexandria and some of those cities were renowned for libraries or you know, learning centers that were considered to be the best knowledge of the world. That was a very brief time. And that was when a lot of the ideas began to coalesce in a slightly different way, where there became more of a sense of a universal kind of teaching. That would take some of the ideas of the outer and the inner and try to see what system might work with them all. This eventually became what was the backbone of the Western mysteries. It went through a lot of different changes because after that period, then again the political scene arose, and then there was a lot of warring, and then a lot of suppression and underground activity and this, that, and the other, and the kind of thing that happens when there is trying to establish a one rule so that we can get everybody on this one wavelength and you won't disagree with me and we can, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you've sort of had that clan thing where you had to watch for who was trying to take power from you in the background, it would be that myth still going. Does that make sense? In a way, if one could look at the whole history of humans on this planet, it would make perfect sense. If you can understand how each group thrived and why their beliefs became this or that or the other. Because there are the heavy actions and there are the habitual actions, and it's almost inevitable to be able to see how they're going to lead. Eventually what happened was that the Western mysteries, what are now called the Western Mystery Schools, and such teaching tools as the tarot, were driven underground. When they first began to emerge again was with the Masons, basically. with Masonry, Freemasonry, mm-hmm. was the first when it was actually starting to become more public, and there was at that time quite a large difficulty between Masonry and Catholicism. Catholicism forbade anyone to marry a Mason. If they did, they were excommunicated at that time. So you can understand how touchy it was to move back to exploring some of these ideas that were more a mixture of belief in the material, belief in the occult, and belief in the power of language to find the meeting place between the two, which is essentially what the Western Mysteries is based on.
So did the Western Mysteries come out of the Masons, or the
no,
Masons
the Masons
came out of the Western Mysteries?
What Masons are the most visible aspect of the Western Mysteries.
Okay. When did they start?
When did the Masons start? What, 15th century?
That's something.
15th? 16th century? When was Luther?
14th.
Yeah, so 14th, 15th century probably. 14th, 15th century sometime. After
the Cathars and things.
Yeah, and in that, you know, the 14th century was really when you began to hear more from Freemasons, from Western Mysteries. And where they can trace, for example, they can trace the origin of tarot decks to the 14th century. 15th, 14th, somewhere around there, I believe. I hope I remember it correctly. It's been many years since I studied tarot as a meditation system. How tarot has been presented has been very superficial a lot of the time, because it is presented as if it were speaking about linear time. And the language of the Western Mysteries, the most important language of the Western Mysteries, just like the important language of any religious belief, I don't care what religious belief, any religious belief is valid. Because the number one language of all religious beliefs is how to be here now in a state of totality. Isn't it? Not feel separate, not feel something lacking. How to be a manifestation of totality of the absolute in the relative. It's called the two-in-one truth in Buddhism. And that isn't linear. That transcends time. So this book was not the one I wanted. Unfortunately, the one I wanted to work from, I lent to someone, and I can't remember who I lent it to about a year ago. And they haven't returned it. However, until I find another book, this one is good enough. This is the one that I started studying tarot with my beloved teacher, Namjoon Rinpoche. He introduced me to the tarot. And then several times he told me I should meditate on this card or that card. And then he taught it many times when he was Ananda Bodhi on. So, this is Paul Foster Case. Appropriately enough, this was Morris's copy. He gave it to me. I had a copy, and again, I had lent it to someone, and I was telling him I had lent my copy to someone. He was asking me if I would look up something in the tarot books. He didn't have his with us. And I said, you know, I've lent, you know, This was like 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So he gave me his copy.
He left a bag of material for me. I should go look through it again and see what he actually left.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I thought that was quite appropriate that I'm bringing Morris's copy first. He would be very pleased with this topic. And what I'm going to do, I would suggest you might, if you're really interested in understanding Western mysteries, this may be a good book to get. There's also some other books that are a little more modern language. And I'll try to remember who I've lent the book to, or else get another copy before we continue again next month. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we'll start with this book, and we'll start with the first part of the introduction talks about the history a bit, and I'm not going to go over that for this class, but if you get a copy, you can read it yourself. The oldest examples of tarot design now preserved in European museums were probably made about 1390. According to an occult tradition in which I am inclined to place confidence, the actual date of its invention was about the year 12,000. The inventors, this tradition avers, were a group of adepts who met at stated intervals in the city of Fez in Morocco. After the destruction of Alexandria, Fez became the literary and scientific capital of the world. Thither, from all parts of the globe, came wise men of all nations speaking all tongues. Their conferences were made difficult by differences in language and philosophical terminology. So they hit upon the device of embodying the most important of their doctrines in a book of pictures, whose combinations should depend on the occult harmonies of numbers. Now you got symbols and numbers with the tarot. Perhaps it was a Chinese adept who suggested the idea, for the Chinese have a proverb, one picture is worth 10,000 words. Did you know that was Chinese?
Good.
And Chinese writing is made up of conventionalized pictures. These pictures express ideas instead of words, so that Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans, although they speak more than 7 different languages, communicate easily with one another if only they can read and write. Although each one of them also has their own particular alphabet, the base of all their alphabets for writing is the Chinese. Interesting, eh?
Mm-hmm.
As a skeleton for their invention, the wise men chose the relatively simple system of numbers and letters afforded by the Kabbalah, or secret wisdom, of Israel. This esoteric doctrine, apparently Jewish, was really a development of ideas fundamentally identical with the wisdom taught in the secret schools of China, Tibet, and India. Some account of it, therefore, must precede our study of the tarot itself. So next, the Hebrew wisdom. And it is true that to really understand what the tarot is talking about, a large part of tarot is based on Kabbalistic wisdom, the mysteries of Kabbalah. The master key to the Hebrew wisdom is the, quote, name, end quote, translated, quote, Lord, end quote, in the authorized version of the Bible, and Jehovah in the revised versions. It is not really a name at all, but rather a verbal, numerical, and geometrical formula. In Roman letters corresponding to Hebrew, it is spelled, do you know it? IHVH. Mm-hmm. That sounded all familiar? Mm-hmm. You've seen it at least mm-hmm. on Christmas cards?
Mm-hmm.
IHVH. This is a noun form derived from a Hebrew verb meaning to be. Correctly translated, it means that which was, that which is, that which shall be. all together. So not linear, do you understand? Past, present, and future brought to one point, which is no longer. You know, the Buddha said, I tell you that you're not in the past, neither are you in the future, neither are you between the two. Which is, you know, the Buddhist way, by negation of saying that which was, that which is, and that which was, what that which is, that which shall be. Which is the Western way of saying the same thing. Something that collects in the moment. And so, to be. That, not he. That's what Kay says. That, not he. Thus it is a perfect verbal symbol for the one reality, for that something which has always subsisted behind all forms in the eternity of the past, for that something which really is behind all appearances and misunderstandings of the present, for that something which will be the foundation for all the changing forms of life expression in the eternity to come. So the absolute and the relative. Is that clear? So you understand why I was talking about the longing. Never has ageless wisdom attempted to define this one reality. Its inner nature defies analysis, cannot be put within the limits of any formal statement, because the one reality is infinite. Yet in every age the report of the wise has been that in the one something inheres the power to know. Although there is no definition, there is knowing. Which is quite interesting, worthy of much contemplation. Because from our point of view, to know doesn't mean to know, it means to know something, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what it can articulate.
Consciousness without object is not something we're familiar with considering.
But would all knowing be the same? Like if you got your, say, your northern cloud or your tropical cloud, would, like, universal knowing would be the same, but
yeah.
Here, knowing would be different.
Yeah.
No?
That something which is really behind all the appearances and misunderstandings. No, it's something which has always subsisted behind all forms in the eternity of the past. For that something which is really behind all the appearances and misunderstandings of the present, for that something which will be the foundation for all the changing forms of life expression in the eternities to come.
Okay.
Yes.
Isn't someone who like that expression, I don't understand it, consciousness which has no legs, or has a blue roof with no legs? I understand the winds with no eyes part. I have a sense for that, but not the first part. Consciousness has no legs or something, or whatever it is. I don't understand that.
Consciousness, in order to manifest, consciousness which has no legs, in order to manifest, rides winds which have no eyes, in order to manifest, in order to ignore totality and come into individuality. So the answer is no, yes, or yes, no, or that which was, that which is, that which shall be, regardless of how the individuality arises and falls.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Is this interesting to you?
Mm-hmm. So would wholesome and unwholesome fall in the same thing, where there wouldn't be the division of north and south kind of thing?
I don't understand the two. Unwholesome and wholesome fall into the same thing?
Well, earlier you were talking about wholesome and unwholesome, and then you were talking about, you know, life is easier in, say, the tropics, right? But here, you know, we set up more, in the north, you have to set up more structure.
You have to have a furnace.
You have to have a furnace, right?
If you want to take your jacket off in the winter.
Right. So would, in the two, let's call them cultures, right, in the two mind thoughts or whatever, would wholesome and unwholesome be the same, since the whole kind of structure and way of life is so different?
Maybe, maybe not. I visited the Amazon and didn't get to go to where the Yanomamo tribe were, although I was very interested in them. But I went to see another tribe who for 15 years haven't killed anybody. Who also had a similar culture to the Yanomamo. And the Yanomamo people, I was really fascinated by reading about them because, you know, this friend of mine who was an anthropologist and used to go and spend time with tribes knew the person who had spent some time with them and survived it. Their whole culture was based on war. Their whole culture was based on war. So what was fun for them was like, what was wholesome and respected was for fun, instead of playing hockey or jousting or, you know, what they would do is they had this beverage that they made that was quite alcoholic, and two guys would stand there and take a swig of it and then stand there and hit, one would hit the other on the head as hard as he could. And then the other one would take that hit, and then that guy would stand there, and this one would hit him. And whoever could stand the longest with as much drink as they wanted was the hero. I mean, what good their brain was after that, one might wonder. Another thing they prided themselves on was their ability to war. So they used to have their villages, and always with little traps coming into them, and they would move their village all the time, and they would have their garden over in a different spot and have secret paths to get to it, because they were always finding out where other villages were and going in and killing everybody and stealing their women, because they didn't treat women very well. So that was their established culture, and that was good, you know. So good and bad have more to do with how you are going to aspire to come to an understanding of what is important in your life. If I always lie, I am going to think a good liar is really worthwhile. I really admire somebody who lies well, because I have to assume if I lie, of course everybody lies. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of my value system is how to look like I'm believing somebody without believing them for a moment. Is that true? So how am I ever going to learn something beyond what I already know? So already I have established a belief system that limits my intelligence. I only brought that up, the wholesome and the unwholesome, just to show that all the belief systems are basically ruled by two things: habituation and heavy actions. Does that help?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I just wanted to set that one aside right away.
Mm-hmm.
So I just introduced it. Probably it just confused it, you know, because I have this mind that always would go, yeah, but the details. I just thought, well, we'll get that detail out right away. We haven't seen you for a long time. Nice to see you.
I'm sorry I'm late. I'm caretaking.
Oh, yeah, because like we have established since you were last here a fine. What is it?
I don't know.
Every minute someone is late. How much was it, Francine? Do you remember?
It's been adding up.
Mine does dark chocolate for dinner.
Oh,
chocolate, is it?
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten that. Thank you, Dawn. I knew someone would come up with a fine. So we'll collect later.
All right, definitely.
And if you didn't bring it, you'll have to eat that much. Because there's some downstairs.
No, thank you.
Oh, no. Or offer it to others.
Mm-hmm.
See, then we're really strict about our rules. We've gotten very strict since we last saw
That's a habit.
It's a new habit. I started a couple of minutes ago.
I see that. I don't want a bonk on the head, thank you.
So we're talking about Western mysteries, and this is our first class. We're going to do a series probably on tarot. And is that gone now? Can I carry on here?
Mm-hmm.
So IHVH, we're talking about... So never has ageless wisdom attempted to define this one reality. Its inner nature defines analysis, cannot be put within the limits of any formal statement, because the one reality is infinite. Yet in every age, the report of the wise has been that in the one something inheres the power to know. We say, therefore, that IHVH is a verbal symbol for the conscious energy that brings all things and creatures into existence. The Kabbalah classifies all possible operations of this one energy into four planes. Rather like Buddhism, body, speech, mind, and three together, the fourth reality. Does that make sense?
What's the fourth reality?
When the three are operating together, each in their own realm and without.
Does that have a name?
Yeah, it's called Nirvana. So the Kabbalah classifies all possible operations of this one energy into four planes or worlds. Each plane or world is represented by a letter of IHVH. Each one of the letters is one world or one plane. As follows, the archetypal world. This is the world of pure ideas. In the archetypal plane are the root notions inherent in the innermost nature of the universal conscious energy. From these ideas are derived all actual forms of manifestation. For example, the pure idea of a chair is the idea of sitting. In that idea, as in all others, is embodied a volition, the will to sit. This will to sit is the single root notion behind all possible chair forms that ever have been, are now, or ever shall be. Thus, the archetypal world is seen to be the plane of will ideas. To it, ageless wisdom assigns the element fire, representing universal radiant energy. In IHVH, this world and this element are represented by the letter I. The creative world. Here the ideas of the archetypal world are specialized as particular patterns. Sitting becomes the mental pattern for some special kind of chair. The cosmic energy acting on this plane contains the patterns of all chairs that have been made or thought of in the past, of all existing in the present, but that not these as yet unthought of. So with all other patterns of particular forms. To this world, ageless wisdom assigns the element water, symbolizing the fluid plasticity of the cosmic mind stuff. The creative world is represented in IHVH by the first H. Notice we're running into the elements again.
Mm-hmm.
The formative world. Here the archetypal ideas, specialized in creative patterns, are brought forth into actual expression. It is the plane of processes, the world of forces behind the veil of physical things. The formative world is that which is now explored by physicists and chemists. It is the world of vibratory activities and also the astral plane of occultism. Here take place the various kinds of action whereby the cosmic energy actualizes its patterns. Ageless wisdom assigns to this world the element air, representing the life energy which wise men everywhere have associated with breath. The formative world is represented by the V in IHVH. The material world, this is the plane of the actual forms which affect our physical senses. Here the process of bringing down the idea of sitting through an operation based on the pattern of a particular chair is finally completed as the chair itself. This plane corresponds to the element earth, representing the solidity and tangibility of physical objects. It corresponds to the second H in IHVH. In every one of the four worlds, the Kabbalah conceives the operation of 10 aspects of the universal conscious energy. 10 aspects. This idea that all possible aspects of the one reality may be reduced to a tenfold classification is found in every version of the ageless wisdom. Thence arises the esoteric teaching concerning the meaning of numbers. This is a subject almost limitless in its ramifications, but what is needed for tarot study will be found in the next chapter. Kind of like, the way he writes that is kind of like monkey, isn't it? And if you want to know what happened next, you'll have to read the next chapter. You ever read Monkey? More lifetimes. Occult meaning of numbers. In this chapter, we shall consider the occult significance of the numbers from 0 to 10, with particular reference to the esoteric means of the so-called Arabic numerals. Who knew you were going to do arithmetic? As a matter of fact, these numerals were invented by Hindu priests from whom they were borrowed and slightly altered by the Arab mathematicians who introduced them to Europe. The key to the meaning of the numerals is the diagram which appears as the front piece of the book, this one. The basis of this diagram is the cross triangles for the Star of David, which also, if you remember, is Vajra Yogini's particular emblem. Do you see it? Do you see apex? And then the other one, the bottom. See? So you have the triangle, the Star of David. Then within that, the rectangle of where the outer higher and lower crosses meet, right? And then from that, from here to the center, from that line to the center, and then from that, halfway to that, to the center, to draw this circle first. You draw the circle there from that. So here are 10 circles, no, six, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Here is a rectangle. Here are I'll let him talk about it because I'm looking at it upside down while I'm trying to describe it to you. But this includes all the numbers, 1, 2, so forth. All right.
Not Roman numeral numbers. the R numbers.
Yeah, Arabic. Mm-hmm. Readers of these pages who are familiar with occult symbolism will perceive that the basis of the construction of this diagram is the six-pointed star known as the Shield of David and the star of the macrocosm. Years ago, one of the theosophical masters declared that the system of six circles, tangent to a central seventh, is a key to the construction of the cosmos. At that time, the master's meaning was not grasped by the student to whom the statement was made. He's talking about himself and somebody who told him that when he was studying with him. It happens for the best of us. I hope the inclusion of this diagram in the front of the book may stimulate some of my readers to further research. Want of space forbids my developing the various details. I shall therefore content myself by saying that this one diagram is the key to the geometrical construction of the Great Pyramid, to a very close approximation to the squaring of the circle, to the true occult meaning of the apron worn by Freemasons, to the correct construction of the Kabbalistic diagram known as the Tree of Life, which is being called a key to all things, and to the proportions of the mysterious vault in which the body of the founder of the Rosicrucian Order is said to have been discovered. These are but a small selection of the mysteries to which this one diagram affords a clue. I shall confine myself to its numerical significance. In Arabic notations, all numbers are represented by 10 symbols, beginning with 0 and ending with 9. It's a little different than we usually think of it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We usually think beginning with 1 and ending with 10. Mm-hmm. But really, 0, an ellipse representing the cosmic egg. So you saw that in the diagram. Whence come all things? All things are born from the cosmic egg. 0 is a symbol of the absence of quality, quantity, or mass. Thus it denotes absolute freedom from every limitation whatsoever. Shunya. It is a sign of the infinite and eternal conscious energy, itself no thing, though manifested in everything. It is that which was, is, and shall be forever, but it is nothing we can name. Boundless, infinitely potential, living light, it is the rootless root of all things, of all activities, of all modes of consciousness. In it are included all imaginable and unimaginable possibilities, but it transcends them all. The Kabbalists call it A, no thing, B, the boundless, C, limitless light, pure conscious energy above and beyond thought. To us it is super consciousness. The descending arc of the ellipse on the reader's left represents the involution, the winding up process, whereby limitless light manifests itself in name and form. So this is coming down, you know, coming down from heaven into earth. I keep losing my place. There it is. At B, the lowest point of involution, there, is reached. The lowest point of involution is reached in the mineral kingdom. From B back to A, on the right side of the ellipse, the ascending arc represents evolution, the unwinding process. From B to F is the arc of evolution in the inorganic world. from F to H is the arc of organic development up through plants and animals. From H to D is the arc of organic development from the lowest animal to the highest type of human consciousness at point D. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't quite have it turn enough for you before. Only a few human beings have reached this point, but the race is nearer to it now than ever before. The arc from D to A is that of conscious expression beyond human levels, the evolution of conscious oneness with the divine. Thus the two sides of the ellipse suggest the esoteric doctrine of involution or descent and a corresponding evolution or ascent. The ascending arc corresponds to the occult doctrine, first the stone, then the plant, then the animal, then the man, and at last the god. 1. In the diagram, the number 1, how's that, is the vertical line. You should see that all by yourselves, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
From A to B, connecting the extreme height with the extreme depth. Among the many occult meanings of this number are beginning, initiative, originality, unity, singleness, isolation, and the like. In the Kabbalah, it is called the crown, to show that one represents the determining, ruling, directive, and volitional aspect of consciousness. The crown is known also as the primal will. The same Hebrew philosophy calls this number the hidden intelligence, to show that this primary mode of consciousness is concealed behind all veils of name and form. This is the consciousness of the true self, or I am, the onlooker, seeing through creation through countless eyes, manifesting itself through innumerable personalities. Ageless wisdom teaches that all things are manifestations or projections in time and space of the powers of the I am. In short, the I am, or number one, is the essence, substance, energy, and consciousness expressed in all forms. Everything in the universe is the self-expression of the I am. This is the first principle, the primary existence, the first mover. In and through human personality, it manifests as the waking self-consciousness. On the diagram, the number 2 begins at C, there. It goes up. Follows the upper circle through D to the center of the diagram, thence through the lower circle to E, and then here to E, and then across. And is completed by the horizontal line from E to F. The meanings of the number include, can you see it? Yeah. Duplication, reflection, receptivity, dependence, alternation, antagonism, and the like. Kabbalists call it wisdom, the reflection of the perfect self-consciousness of the I am. Wisdom is the mirror wherein the I am sees itself. The number 2 is also named illuminating intelligence. It is that which illuminates the personal mind. It is the aspect of universal consciousness which manifests through human personality as grasp of the inner principles of the nature of the one conscious energy. In Hebrew occultism, 2 is also the particular number of the life force in all creatures. This is going to be a little bit dull today because I'm just going to read this to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterward, we can talk a little more. Is that all right? Because
mm-hmm.
I think it's better just to present these ideas and you get what you can or not, and either get the book or, you know, get Xeroxes or whatever. 3. The upper half of this figure is the same as the upper half of 2. from C through D to the center. Oh, sorry, C through D to the center, to there. Its lower half begins at the center of the diagram and follows the lower circle through F and B around to E. So that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Among the meanings of three are multiplication, development, growth, unfoldment, therefore expression. Three signifies the actual outworking of the principles reflected from one by two. Want me to read that again?
Mm-hmm.
Three signifies the actual outworking of the principles reflected from one by two. So one is self, what did they call it? Self-consciousness. Two is the life force in all creatures, which is mirroring the inner principles of the nature of the one consciousness. So the self is, self-consciousness is one, and then the reflective kind of nature's consciousness. Those two working together, right? Did that make it more confusing, or did you get it?
Is that like this?
A bit like that. In Kabbalah, three is understanding, looking forward into the field. So, three signifies the actual outworking of the principles reflected from one by two. So, two reflects principles from one. And three is the outcome of that reflection. In Kabbalah, three is understanding, looking forward into the field of manifestation. In contrast to wisdom, too, which looks back to the self-knowledge of I am. Understanding is the concrete application of abstract wisdom. Hence, three is called the sanctifying intelligence, to convey the idea that through growth or expression comes the perfected manifestation of the potencies latent in the limitless light. Whatever arises is a manifestation of the potencies latent in totality. On the form side, perfect realization, sanctification, requires perfected organism. In consciousness, it is perfected faculty and function. That will get clearer as we get more into some of the cards and stuff, but because the cards all are numbers, this gives you a sense why each one is, the number is also important for each one. Four, it shows you where, what its role or what its scope is within the diagram of the tree of life. This figure starts with the vertical line of the figure one, and adds two other lines, A to G, and G to H. So it goes, right? Thus drawn, four shows in its upper portion a triangle, symbol of the number three, and its lower portion a T-square, a geometric symbol of four itself. Triangle and T-square are among the most important instruments of the draftsman. They have occult reference to the esoteric side of geometry. They suggest planning, surveying, topography, and the like. From these considerations are derived the following meanings of four: order, measurement, classification, recording, tabulation, and so on. Because of these meanings, Kabbalists make four the number for memory. Because the life power is perfect memory of its own potencies and of the needs of even the least of its centers of expression, cannot be supposed to fail, the idea of beneficence, good givingness, is also assigned to four. this beneficence is not wasteful of prodigality. I'm having a real hard time pronouncing words today. All the gifts of the life power are measured out. Every center of expression reaves exactly what is coming to it, always. Therefore, the number is four is called the measuring intelligence. 5, on the diagram, the first line of this figure is the horizontal C to D, there. The second line is vertical C to I. C to I, straight down there. I'm sure you'll see the rest of it by yourself, won't you? The third includes 5/6 of the lower circle from I through F and B to E. From I meanings of 5 include mediation, because 5 is the middle number between 1 beginning and 9 completion. Adaptation, means, agency, activity, process, and the like. 5 is the dynamic law proceeding from abstract order, 4. To primitive minds, the working of law seems to be the operation of many forces, mostly hostile to man. Hence, 5 is the number of versatility. And one of its names in Kabbalah is fear. Ignorant persons endeavor to propitiate the powers they fear. Their sacrifices are the beginning of religious ritual. Hence 5 is the number of religion. A better, though incomplete, knowledge of law sees it as a relentless, harsh, mechanical expression of mathematical principles, taking no account of human needs and aspirations. You've heard me talk about this before. There are 3 main ways that belief starts. First is superstition. 2nd is science, in its most derogatory way of using the word. Do you understand? 1st is, oh, there are gods and we should propitiate them, but we don't know whether they'll accept our propitiation or not because they're very changeable. 2nd is, there are no gods, there's reason for everything, and, you know, humans don't really have any particular say one way or the other. Right? So that's what he's talking about, these 3. A better, though incomplete, knowledge of law sees it as a relentless, harsh, mechanical expression of mathematical principles, taking no account of human needs and aspirations. This is the interpretation of the materialist who sees the law as a mighty power. Hebrew sages take account of this also and say that 5 is the number of strength and severity as well as of fear. Finally, to seers and sages, law appears as the manifestation of perfect justice, whereby man, whose numerical symbol is also 5, may so adapt natural conditions that he may realize progressive liberation from every kind of bondage. 5 is where there is an understanding that cause and effect is true, and that we are not separate from totality. So the 3 levels of belief. There is a God and we can't do anything, but we should propitiate him in case it works. There is no God, it's all cause and effect. Cause and effect is true, and we are not separate from totality. Which, if there was a God, it would be totality. Or beyond individuality. So those are the 3 levels of belief systems that, according to Western mysteries and the traditions that I was taught of Western mysteries, are include all the different ways that humans evolve in their understanding through those 3 levels. Interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something I can do? All of us have all 3. There are times when we really feel like if I only knew the right thing to do, the gods would smile at me in one way or the other. Or, well, there's nothing anyway, it's up to me, you know, and like, and my life is, you know, the gods don't give a shit about me, and, you know, there are no gods, actually, and it's all cause and effect, so which cause, who shall I talk to get this to, and there isn't any. And then the heart joins the mind, and some other turn happens. Five then is the number of versatility because it shows the changing aspects of the one law, inspiring fear in the ignorant, perceived by the materialist as relentless strength, and understood by the wise as undeviating justice. This one law is the root of all operations of the life power and is therefore called radical intelligence. The root consciousness expressed through human personality is this one law of mediation or adaptation. Man can change conditions. This is the secret of his power to realize freedom.
To realize
freedom, which is what the Buddha taught too. What's that? It, you are not sentenced by your karma. It's what Milarepa's life story teaches, isn't it? Milarepa, the murderer, or Angulimala, the murderer. Six, on the diagram, this is a continuous line from D to A. D to A, drawing down, and then going around like that. You can see that, of course, by yourselves. D to A, down through the ellipse on the involution curve to the B, then around the lower circle to B. Its symmetry suggests the philosophical conception of beauty. This is a direct outcome of ideas expressed by the preceding numerals. F, a free life power, zero, knowing itself perfectly, one, grasping all possibilities of what it is in itself, two, understanding just how these possibilities may be worked out into expression, three, never forgetting itself or any detail of the perfect order of self-manifestation, four, developing that order through the agency of a perfectly just law or method, five, must inevitably be working toward a perfectly symmetrical, balanced, and therefore beautiful result, six. This idea is implicit in the following meanings of six. Balance, equilibration. God, help my tongue. Manjushri, where are you? Symmetry, beauty, harmony of opposites, reciprocity. It's getting worse. Complementary activities, polarity, love. It is named intelligence of mediating influence, or intelligence of the separated emanations. It's an intriguing title. We'll get there. Seven, on the diagram, this is composed of two lines. The first horizontal from C to D. And the second. The second diagonal from D to E. To exhaust the meanings of seven would take as many pages as an encyclopedia. It is a great biblical number, many books in both the Old and New Testaments being written on a plane of sevens, seven chapters, seven subdivisions, and so on. On this point, see the literary introductions in Moulton's Modern Reader's Bible. The more important occult meanings of seven are rest, safety, security, victory. To the ancients, seven represented temporary cessation, not final perfection, as some have thought. In Hebrew, the word for seven and that for oath are closely related. Since the security and safety of a sworn compact were represented in Hebrew thought by seven, this number stands for the logical consequences of the ideas symbolized by the numbers preceding it in the series. A perfect life power, working in the way outlined in the explanation of six, cannot be supposed to fail. Omnipotence must, and ultimately, no matter what present appearances may be, arrive at a triumphantly successful conclusion to all its undertakings. The great work is as yet unfinished. The cosmic experiment has not come to completion, but when we consider the nature of the source of that experiment, the nature of the worker in that work, reason assures us that it must succeed, down to the minutest detail. the Hebrew name for seven is occult intelligence. Eight on the diagram is a figure composed of the upper and lower circles within the ellipse. In writing it, we begin at A and describe a descending S to B and return on an ascending inverted S to A. Thus, the form of the figure suggests vibration by the shape of the lines and alternation by the two kinds of motion used in describing it. It is also the only figure except zero which may be written over and over again without lifting pen from paper. Mm-hmm. Thus, in mathematics, the figure 8 written horizontally is the sign of infinity. Mm-hmm. Among its occult meanings are rhythm, alternate cycles of involution and evolution, vibration, flux and reflux, and the like. It represents also the fact that opposite forms of expression, that is, all pairs of opposite, are effects of a single cause. This number 8 is the digit value of the name IHVH, Jehovah. 888 is the numeration of the name Jesus in Greek. And 8 is not only the dominical number or number of the Lord in Christian numeral symbolism, but is also the particular number of the god called Thoth by Egyptians, Nebo by Assyrians, Hermes by Greeks, and Mercury by Romans. Thus, 8 is preeminently the number of magic and hermetic science. Its Hebrew name is splendor, and the aspect of consciousness to which it corresponds is called perfect intelligence. So the previous one was occult intelligence. So once you get over 7, then you're into occult intelligence. And perfect intelligence, 8. The Hebrew adjective translated perfect is SH, SH, and then L, and then M, Shlem, Shalom, Shlem. A noun spelt with the same letters means peace, security, health, wealth, satisfaction, Shalom. You've heard that, haven't you? Shalom Aleichem. Aleichem, Shalom. And thus refers to the perfect realization of the success represented by the number 7. 9 on the diagram begins at D. You can see there. Follows the upper circle down to the center of the diagram, continues back to D, then along the line of the ellipse on the right side of the diagram to E. As last of the numeral symbols, 9 represents the following ideas: completion, attainment, fulfillment, the goal of endeavor, the end of a cycle of activity. Yet because 8 indicates rhythm as part of the creative process, completion is not absolute cessation. The end of one cycle is the beginning of another. Gurdjieff said, the key to wisdom is knowing when you're at the drop-off point of one cycle to begin the beginning of the next cycle, so that you go like this, rather than... Gurdjieff very much used Western mysteries in his teaching. It was very important, especially in his movement. Nice to know these things, isn't it? Who knew? Well, me, but that's because I was taught it. This fact is the basis of all practical occultism. Nobody ever comes to the end of his tether. Nobody ever reaches a point where nothing more remains to be hoped for, where nothing remains to be accomplished. Nice to remember that when you have friends like Andrea, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Every end is the seed of a fresh beginning. No matter who we are.
Every what?
End is the seed of a fresh beginning. In Kabbalah, therefore, 9 is called basis or foundation and corresponds to the mode of consciousness named pure or clear intelligence, because the completion of any process is the pure, clear, unadulterated expression of the intention or idea which initiated that process. 10, 1 and 0 together one and zero together. Combines the ellipse of superconsciousness with the vertical line of self-consciousness. Totality, individuality in one number. It's quite beautiful, isn't it? It is the number of perfection and dominion. It is a number read from right to left, from units to tens, as all composite figures should be read symbolically. It suggests the outpouring of the limitless life power through the initiative, specialization, and concentration of the I Am. Kabbalists call the number 10 the kingdom. The mode of consciousness assigned to it is resplendent intelligence, brilliant, glowing, full of life and power. In one esoteric text, this mode of intelligence is said to have its seat in understanding, and understanding is the number 3, or sanctifying intelligence. What is meant is that in order to have the resplendent, glowing consciousness of mastery, one must have also, as a basis, the sanctifying, perfecting, organizing power of understanding. Our citizenship in the kingdom of heaven on earth is determined by the degree of our understanding. Such is the outline of the 10 primary numbers. This is the most concise I have ever seen, the numbers defined in Western Mysteries teaching and without too much language. That a lot of the Western Mysteries was written in very disguised language because it was under threat, and then when it became out of under threat, there was that sense also of the value of keeping it secret or, you know, hidden, kind of like Tibetans, the Wongkors and the initiations you get. When you are given a teaching, there's usually a couple of what look like mistakes written into the text. Did you know this?
No.
And not until you go back and get further teaching and you've done some retreat work are you told what it really means, mm-hmm. which stops them from being put out and copied and sent out mm-hmm. by people who haven't got the understanding. And it's the same with the Western Mysteries that has that same. It's one of those things that most people don't know. How curious it is, huh? Because you hear people all the time. I hear people all the time arguing about the right text. And I may have received some teaching that says, well, actually, this is. And I sit there with my mouth shut. And yeah, oh, geez, yeah, I think you're right. There could be a mistake in them doing that one. Mm-hmm. Not to mention this one. But I'm not mentioning this one. Who had their hand up? You did? You had your hand up?
Well, I was just going to say, I was in the Rosicrucian Order for 17 years, and you know, you're only taught gradually, little by little by little, and it's very much kept secret.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Stuff from that time. Mm-hmm. And a value to it in a certain way. Because you actually have to think about mm-hmm. what you received.
Yeah.
So you don't get it all at once and say, oh, is that all? And don't, you know? Sometimes I think I teach way too much because you don't really have the time to digest it, but then I tend to go over and over the same material, so sometimes you hear it for the first time even though you've heard it 5,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think there's lots of ways of going about it. Somebody else had their hand up? Yes.
Rinpoche did some long course when he was alive at Gurgalaj. I remember him coming back and giving those secrets.
But do you remember what the teaching on it? But do you remember what the sadhanas were, or what the teachings, the Wongkors were?
No.
Or you could ask somebody else who was there.
Sure.
Couldn't you? So if you have the name of them, if you know anybody who's, you know, maybe done a lot of that kind of work, they might have a collection of sadhanas, and they might be able to give you the work that you do with it. If you knew anybody like that.
I'll check them out.
Yeah. You never know who they are. Or not. So, shall I carry on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. such is the outline of the 10 primary numbers according to ageless wisdom as handed down to us through the sages of Israel. It affords a basic clue to the meaning of tarot. For instance, the whole book or pack of cards contains 78 pages. 78 cards, 78 pages. It's actually a book, the tarot. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a book whose story has endless possibilities of telling.
Mm-hmm.
The storyline can go any way. Depends how you shuffle the cards. First the story goes this way, and then you turn it that way, and then it goes that way. Quite a beautiful idea, isn't it? Interpreting the number 78 from the foregoing, we see that it represents the expression of the splendor of the perfect intelligence 8 through the victory of occult intelligence 7. Splendor of perfect intelligence, becoming, opening yourself to the beauty of perfect intelligence through the victory, through winning your way to understand what has been hidden from you. The mystery that has been hidden to you. Occult means the hidden. What you're searching for in the outer and is always hidden is not hidden so far away. In the practical work of the builders of the Aditum, the esoteric meanings of the numeral symbols have been expanded into a series of 11 statements or affirmations. These are entitled the pattern on the trestle board, because while they are at all times true of the real self at the heart of every human personality, they are not intended to be taken as vainglorious claims of personal attainment. They are the capital S self, not the small S self. Right? They're at the heart of your being, but they're not you. They're not Cecily. They will aid the reader to remember the main attributes of the numbers 0 to 10. More than this, they have, during the last 25 years, proved their value as seed ideas, which planted in the mind by thoughtful and purposeful repetition, bear rich fruit in mental and spiritual unfoldment. So I think I'll stop there for tonight. Maybe I will get this Xeroxed. So those of you who want copies of it, until you get your own book or don't or decide not to. From now, then the next part is about the construction of the tarot, and it talks about the four worlds, the four elements, and each world has so many cards within it, from 1 to 10, and then the four court cards. 4, 10, 4, 10, 4, 10. And then there are the major arcana. So the minor arcana is four worlds. And the pentacles, cups, swords, and wands are the representation. Pentacles are earth, cups are water, swords are fire, wands are air. And so there's 10 of the cards of pentacles. And then there are the four court cards, which are page, knight, queen, and king. For each one of them, that's true. So you go through the 10 and then the 4. The 10 numbers of the learning curve, and then the 4. 4 levels of the four worlds, learning how to manifest that, right? The four planes. Remember the four planes?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the minor arcana. Then the major arcana is 21 cards. Starting with 0 and ending with 20. 22 cards. any with 21. So three times of seven. Three levels of seven. Three levels of developing occult intelligence. Based on this numerical explanation. Right? So the rulers, the ruling, the archetypal energies that manifest the four levels, the four groups of tens, right? There are seven times three of 21. And the 22nd is the zero, the fool, the unknowing. This book basically deals, so you can see how it's talking about the four planes, which I refer to as body, speech, and mind in the four. But here they have it as slightly different. But it will be up to you to start exploring that. I would not try too much to compare this to the Tibetan until you have a pretty good grasp of how the whole thing is laid out, because there are quite different ways of seeing, as there would be if you had different seasons in different cultures. The principles may be there, but the way they're introduced, you know, fire would be quite different in northern Canada than it would be in the tropics, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Fire would be something you might want to get away from in the tropics, but fire might save your life in the north, you know? So like I'm saying, there is quite a difference in terms of the language, the cultural language, and how the symbolism is used. So I wouldn't necessarily try to just translate it by what you've learned of the Buddhist. Keep this as separate. There will be many things about this that will make much better sense to you, because this is actually from the Western culture. And this is basically the mystical tradition of the West that was stepped outside of organized religions, but has existed for a very long time.
So what is considered the West?
I'm talking about the Orient and the Occident, sort of those cultures. In a way, the East has to do more with cultures that grew in countries where there was like more pleasing climate, surrounded by oceans or mountains, so that they had that kind of ability to eat well, but question things. Every once in a while, marauders would move in, but there was a sense of lifetimes. And the West had more to do with, well, what you might have done wrong because your house got burned down by those marauders, because there was this, you know, bad season up there. And
so Persia would be considered the West?
And it's sort of a little of both in some ways, because the desert made, you know, it has a little kind of a little of both. It tends to go for the good and bad, but it still has the, you know. But generally speaking, the cultures today that believe in the kind of a vengeance kind of motif in the gods are more from Western civilizations. And the cultures that believe in you're in a learning curve over lifetimes, and you know, this lifetime you deserve what you get, but really, you know, keep climbing the ladder, my son, and soon you'll work to the top of it. You know, tend to me more for like, you know, well, seasons come and go, don't worry about it, so it's bad crop of mangoes falling this year, next year, you know. And this is such a general statement, but it gives a sense of why there is that division. It makes sense of it for me when I sat and figured that out. And then there was was it Zoroaster or one of the philosophers I was reading when I was trying to think what made it such a difference. And then one of the early philosophers made that statement that he thought that that was had a fact, you know. And I'm more likely to believe something if I find somebody else saying it who's, you know, written a few books and been respected.
Mm-hmm. So is I Ching or the hexagram?
The
I Ching? Is that east or west then?
Chinese. So it's more, China was for a long time quite protected. Orient. But I'm sure if you look at it, you'll see it yourself. Or know a lot, and then you can come and tell me why my theory is full of holes, and I probably misread the book. That agreed with me.
Well, I was wondering with the hexagrams are more Western in a sense, like it's a little more of the numerology type of thing.
No, they're not. No, they're not. All of them have the hexagrams. Hexagram is basically the cross. Time, knowing, space, being. Yang yang, yin yin, yang yin, yin yang. And then three different ways of them occurring, of those lines, doubled on heaven and on earth. So the solid or the broken line. Solid line is yang. If it's all three coins the same, yang yang, right? If it's two of the three, yang ying, right? Still solid, but the majority, right? Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see that it's like the four possible ways of being masculine before an experience, you know, the archetypal before, meeting with all possibility, and then afterward naming it. Number one, number four. Number two, number three. Knowing and being. In Buddhism, how consciousness and material dance together to find salvation from the pain of separation. Being in a body, you're always separated. Right? So how to use the dance of individual to find the power of totality. So it's called liberation. So it's still knowing and being, how consciousness and body knit namarupa with a little hyphen in between, that relationship. Now that is the basis of all the teachings, how consciousness in form can come to a state of totality. How separateness can manifest an awareness of perfection, non-separate. Isn't that right? One that nobody like me will argue with you about, especially. That would be particularly good. I mean, they could, but you would know that that was you arguing with you, as there's no separateness. Etc. So was that? I mean, that was a little dry, but was it interesting? Did you get some?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, goody! So you want me to Xerox this and have some copies for next time?
I don't think so.
I suggested it, but I don't know whether you actually got it. Paul Foster Case, I did suggest it, but I don't know if you got it.
Well, unless the book looks different now.
Yeah, it does.
It's
got a different cover.
This is what its hardcover used to look like. This is what it looked like when we got it. It might have been reprinted. I mean, it was certainly a popular book when it was put out. This was done in 1947.
So you can see that the language is a bit dated and so forth. And there are other books on the tarot, and I'm sorry that the ones I have I don't find particularly useful in terms of what we want to do, have an understanding of the basis behind it, rather than this card means this,
yeah.
You're going to watch out for dark, unknown women meeting you in daylight at the Safeway. And this also has like Morris's little handwriting in it. It's quite neat, isn't it? It's the Tree of Life from the Kabbalah. There's some very useful things in this book, actually.
You can get it through other good book services if you can't find a reprint.
Yeah. I'll make a few copies and I'll assume that some of you are going to get used copies. It shouldn't be that expensive to buy it.
I'll check Amazon tonight, too, and see if it's still orderable for them.
Good move. Then we can enshrine Morris.
Yeah.
Get the books for all of us. It's kind of fun to have them here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Vaguely, you want me to pass it around so you can all go, hey, Morris.
Maybe you'd be teaching a class if he was here.
Or try to take it off on one of his side railroad lines. The side road. Take it into another direction. Who knows, maybe he is almost here. So, any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints now that we're 5 minutes over time? Just thought I'd slip that in. I think you'll find that now that most of you have a pretty solid kind of basis of Buddhism, especially if you've been coming to the Majjhima Nikaya classes. It really, that those classes really do open you to really understand the scope of Buddhist teaching, don't they?
Yeah.
So now that we've been doing that for a few years, and you have some feel of that, I think you'll find looking at the Western mysteries and hence Western religious beliefs to be quite different than you thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll find them to be very rich and very beautiful. Maybe you will argue with some of the representations or the way they're presented, but the basis of them will be very clear to you. Which is nice, isn't it? To have that clarity, to be open to teaching however it manifests.
Mm-hmm.
Not be caught in one box.
Boring. Boring.
That's what I found. So you notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your heart bones, spreading through your body bones, out through your ear bones and eye bones and feet bones. Fills the moon. Through the whole city, anybody you want to pray for? Wherever there is suffering, body, speech, and mind, wash it. Whatever wholesomeness has been carried by our knowledge, share it with all. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. We share it with all beings. So thank you for your great.